Well, this hour we'll take your phone calls as we talk about the life of super Earths with Dimitar Sasolov. So that'll be next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Dimitar Sasolov, with us. Dimitar, you talk a lot about the transit of Venus, which is coming up in a few months. What is that?
The transit of Venus is one of the first transits ever observed by human. Our two planets, Venus and Mercury, that orbit within the orbit of planet Earth, occasionally pass between us and the Sun. And that mini eclipse, which is called a transit instead, is observed when the dark silhouette, the dark circle of the planet, takes a few hours to cross the bright surface of the Sun. Venus is particularly remarkable because it's large, much larger than the tiny Mercury. It's easier to see, and in addition, it's a very rare event. It only happens once in two generations, meaning 120 odd years. The last time we had a transit of Venus was 8 years ago. They come in pairs now. But after this one, which will be on June 5th, in our country and in Australia, that will be June 6th this summer. After this one, the next one is not for another 121 years. So mark your calendars and try to see it this time. It's not going to be easy to wait for another century and a half for the next one.
Not at all. Okay, let's go to some phone calls. We've got calls this hour with you. We'll go to Justin in the city of New York, New York. Go ahead, Justin. Thanks for calling.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen. How are you doing?
Good, Justin. Thank you.
Great. I'd like to say, first of all, George, I hope your vacation last week was great. I missed you on Friday. That was, you know, unfortunate, but yeah, Stanley was very good as well.
He's a good guy.
And to the guests tonight, I like the way you really explain, you know, the sense of time and the origination of the universe in its embryonic state, is because, you know, a lot of people think that it's sort of like, you know, turnkey. You know, one day this happens, next day that happens. But you really break it down to expose the idea that it's actually an infinite and perpetual occurrence. And, you know, we have to basically just bear witness to it with our satellites and our telescopes. And, you know, you can really answer tough questions because maybe there is no answer.
Thank you, Justin. Yes, it's a fascinating story, isn't it?
You know, and the fact that it's, you know, some odd billions of years old and we're just in the beginning of it only means that, you know, we have a lot to look forward to. And, you know, and you know, we can watch a comet come around twice, you know, as Halley did. And like you mentioned, the Venus eclipse with Mercury every 120 years. But, you know, if that's the case for 120 years, we can extrapolate, you know, the infinite of things to come.
Exactly. Absolutely. You got it right. I mean, We can see enough in the past to do something which scientists called extrapolation, meaning we look at those distant galaxies, we count the stars in them, we see how they develop, and then we see what is the current state of the universe, and then we project that forward, like run the movie forward in the future. And we can see how this will develop for much longer time than it took for it to actually happen in the last 14 billion years. And that's why I was saying with such certainty that we know, we understand the state of the universe as it is today and into the pretty distant future from now. And we know generally the way you see the universe today with the galaxies and the stars is the state that is projected to be the universe in the very distant future from now. So that's why I'm saying we are kind of one of the first generations. I call it generation one in the book. And we are probably at the cusp of where life is moving on to the next generation too. But really, there hasn't been enough time for a new generation to form within that period of the first stars, the first planets, possibly the first forms of life, and us now. We are that first generation in this universe.
Dimitar, when you talk about super Earths, what does that mean, super Earths?
Well, the term that is now used by my colleagues, by scientists, may be a little bit unfortunate. because when we coined it 12 years ago or so, we didn't really think very seriously that we'll be observing those planets anytime soon. And you know how it happens. You know, you don't realize the importance of what is happening at the moment. We use the term, which is very common to astronomers. When I studied stars before they were planets discovered, we often refer to stars as dwarfs and giants. I mean, that's kind of old terminology. The sun is a dwarf star. Well, there are stars that are pretty bright and large, and we call them giants. And then my colleagues discovered even larger stars than those, and we called them supergiants. So astronomy has a lot of that use of the super adjective for things which are bigger than the other thing. Doesn't mean very much more than that. So when we thought about planets which would be larger than the Earth, rocky and otherwise similar to the Earth, but simply larger, and there is no such planet in our solar system, just use that astronomical terminology and call it, well, let's call them super Earth. And now the name stuck and everybody is using it.
All right, next up we go to Brandon driving around in Oregon, west of the Rockies. Brandon, you're on with us. Go ahead.
Yeah, the question I had was regarding how long you think it'll be before we start attempting to terraform another planet or a moon or something, create an atmosphere, introduce species of simple life. Do you see anything like that happening anytime soon?
Thank you for the question, Brandon. I think this will happen eventually. I don't see it happening anytime soon, and the reason I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon, there are two reasons for that. The first one is just I think we are careful about even attempting to do anything like this in our current space exploration. NASA, and for that matter, many of the other national space agencies have what is called an office for planetary protection office. And that office takes care of both protecting other planets and bodies out there from contamination, because, you know, we want to study them. If we send spacecraft, robotic or human spacecraft, which is not well sterilized and contaminated, all we're going to find is our own forms of life, microbes that we hitched and brought there. So that's one reason why we have to be careful. The second reason why this planetary protection office exists is to make sure we don't inadvertently bring something which we don't want to bring back here to Earth. So that's one reason why this is not going to happen anytime soon. The second reason why terraforming is not in the cards in the next 10, 20 years, it's very expensive and difficult to do. We don't really know how to do it. So I think for the time being, what everybody's trying to concentrate on is to make spaceflight cheaper, to really bring the human race into near-Earth orbit and maybe as far as the moon on a more regular basis and not at a huge expense. And then really begin in earnest to explore the solar system. Terraforming will come into the more distant future and probably a couple of generations into that.
Well, that's exciting. What is science doing next? What's beyond Kepler? What's going to give us the kind of information we need, Dimitar, to move ahead?
Good question. We're already thinking about that and very seriously at that, not just thinking, but designing the next step. Kepler is a great telescope, historic telescope. It's giving us and will continue to give us a lot of important data and planets. But what Kepler does is, by design, discovering planets which are fairly far from us. So it's very difficult to study their atmospheres, their surfaces in the detail that we want to study. So what the next big step and spacecraft probably, it will have to be done from space, is to really discover planets which are closer to us in our own neighborhood, so that we can study them better afterwards. Because ultimately, what we are trying to do in the next 10 years is to come to the point where we can study exoplanets and look for signatures of life on them. And the Kepler planets are a little bit too far for this kind of study to be done with the kind of technology we can afford and the kind of technology we are putting into space in the next 10 years. So there is a proposal for a spacecraft that we call TESS, which is a transit survey, again, similar to Kepler, except this time it's looking at the whole sky and at the nearest stars, searching for planets like the Earth orbiting the nearest stars to us. And once we discover them, we will have targets, we'll have planets to train the big new telescope, the James Webb telescope, which is the successor to Hubble, to train that telescope at them and hopefully understand what's on their surfaces in their atmospheres. And maybe if you're lucky, we'll see some signatures for a biosphere.
Let's go out to West Hartford, Connecticut, and Bill is with us. Hi, Bill. Go ahead. Good to have you with us.
Yes. Hi, George. Yes. Hi, Doctor. I am an amateur astronomer myself, and I have two questions for you. The second question is on what you just mentioned, the James Webb Space Telescope, which is NASA's great successor to Hubble that fortunately will be fully funded and launched in 2018. Let me say my first question first on Kepler. Kepler and relating it to the ESA spacecraft, CORROT, Carrot or Corot. My point is, Kepler is aimed at the area of the sky between Cygnus and Lyra, those two constellations. My question number one specifically, will William Borucki, the principal investigator of Kepler, get enough small funds needed to extend the mission three more additional years so it can get more years of data? And along with that, can you describe where Corot, CROT, is aimed at? It's not aimed at the same area of the sky as Kepler. And my second question on James Webb, could you expand on through spectroscopy if and when, hopefully, James Webb will detect life in the atmospheres of some of these extrasolar Earths?
Thank you, Bill. It's great to hear from you. I started when I was in high school as an amateur astronomer and then became a professional. So I have a lot of great friends who are amateur astronomers, and great to hear from you. Now, on your questions, the first question you asked about the extension of the Kepler mission. When we proposed the mission almost 12 years ago now, and it was accepted by NASA, it was accepted for the minimum nominal period of operation, which is 3.5 years, where the idea was that we'll be looking for Earth-sized planets orbiting solar-type stars in the habitable zone, and their periods, not surprisingly, will be the orbital period of the Earth, meaning 1 year. So we counted on three transits to get enough signal to confirm the existence of a planet at that orbit. So 3.5 years kind of gives you the minimum duration of a mission, which we'll be able to do that in a statistically significant fashion. Now, these 3.5 years are now up. The Kepler mission will have to close down later this year if we stuck to the original plan.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we think there is a very strong case to extend the mission. And that case is both for the core mission of getting the right number for the frequency of planets like the Earth, and that has to do with the stellar noise, or the fact that stars are quite variable, as Kepler for the first time is able to see. And that means that we will get much better statistics if we have more than three transits. In fact, six to seven transits for an Earth-sized planet in 1 year orbit is what we are looking for. They're giving us the original numbers that we're looking for. So we have applied to NASA for that extension. Of course, our principal investigator, Bill Borucki, is leading that application, and our team representatives made the case already, and we're anticipating in the next couple of weeks, hopefully, to hear back positively that Kepler will be extended. We want the extension to be for another 4 years, and there are a lot of great results which will come out of that. And frankly, you know, with all the investment that we put as a country into this great mission, it will be a shame if, for a very tiny amount of funds, we don't just continue. The spacecraft is working perfectly well. The data is just as good as ever. It takes very little to continue its operation. So I'm quite confident that NASA will make the decision to extend it. So that's your first question. Your second question was about the James Webb Telescope ability to detect signatures of life. It is difficult to tell at this point because we know very little about the geochemistry, the geophysics of those exoplanets, super-Earths, that we're discovering. James Webb will be the first major telescope which will allow us to study that basic geophysics of such planets. We don't have any super-Earths in our own solar system. And for James Webb, it will be very difficult to do the same for the smallest planets, the size of the Earth and Venus, which we are able to discover currently. So James Webb is going to look mostly at super-Earths, slightly bigger versions of our own Earth. So I think what is going to happen first is we are going to learn a lot about their atmospheres, about the volcanoes they may have, the oceans they may have on their surfaces, and what determines those atmospheres. And once we do that, then we'll know much better whether James Webb is the telescope that is capable of detecting the gases which we call biosignature gases, meaning gases which are only there in the atmosphere because of the imbalance caused by a biosphere, by life on that planet. So I'm cautiously optimistic that James Webb will be capable to achieve that historical feat, but just cautiously optimistic. There is a lot more work to be done. And frankly, it is not really anything to do with the quality of the telescope. The telescope is great as it is now being built and designed. It's just that it is a brand new world or worlds that we are exploring. And it is always a little bit premature to claim that we know what we are going to see across the horizon once we actually have a glimpse of them. So that's why I'm actually keeping an open mind, and I think the reality will be more amazing than we can even imagine at this point.
Okay, well, you stay with us. We're going to come back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM with final phone calls before we move into our next segment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, we're going to talk about the incredible applications of this incredible artificial intelligence. It's getting smarter and smarter. And we'll be back in a moment as we talk about the life of super-Earths with final phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back with Dimitar Sasolov, his work, The Life of Super-Earths. Dimitar, why are we as human beings so obsessed with the possibility, so obsessed with searching for extraterrestrial life?
I was fascinated by this question myself, George. I think it's one of those big questions, big mysteries. But it has also something to do with us, how we view our own place, who are we? And so the more I think about it, the more I think it has to do with what's happening on our planet in the past 50 years, in the beginning of this 21st century. We are now globalized. We know about each other everywhere. There is no more new continents, new lands, new worlds to explore here on this planet. It's essentially covered it all, if you will. And we've met everybody through TV, through books. We know that we are one species with one genetic code. And so there is this longing, which was always there, to have a first encounter, to encounter someone new, somebody like beyond the mountain ridge, somebody in a new continent, new kind of animals, new kind of trees, forests, a new place, really. And so we lost it. And at the same time, we are gaining it in multiple times. So we lost it because we are globalized now. We've kind of covered the planet. It's a small planet. We've seen it. And we've gained it because we've discovered planets like the Earth around other stars. So I think it is this new chapter of having first encounters in our future waiting for us on those other planets.
You know, I don't know why, because without any scientific equipment or know-how, when I was a little boy, Dimitar, I just knew that there were other planets in this universe. I mean, I just knew it. I felt it. To me, the primordial soup was the same. And I feel the same way for intelligent life. I just know that somewhere on some distant planets, probably many, that there is life older than us, younger than us, but much like us, and it's out there. And I don't have any scientific basis for that other than my gut.
And, you know, George, that's why I do what I do as a scientist. That's what was my initial spark and motivation. I was excited about that. And I see human science simply as a tool to develop the technology and to actually go out and explore, to find out for yourself, not just to dream about it, but to actually realize your dreams. And I have to tell you, I really am so excited about it, being able to be lucky enough to live through this time. I am literally in my career living out my dreams, those same dreams that you discussed, talking about, you know, finding out what is out there, really.
Well, and I know as a scientist, you don't speculate. You like to have facts. You want to have the data. But what does your heart tell you, Dimitar, about the possibility of intelligent life out there? Because I'm pretty sure you've thought about it.
Sure, of course I do. And I wrote a little bit in my book about this as well. Because what I'm really trying to do as a scientist is simply to bring us to the point where we can discover life. And by life, I think discoverable life at this point, technically, is more like a biosphere which is made up of microbes, which is what really controlled the atmosphere of the Earth for the past 4 billion years. I mean, that's where the oxygen came from, the microbes, not from animals. So microbes are the easiest to discover, and they probably do it first. That would inhabit the planet, will emerge on a planet. So I'm taking it very practically and in a very kind of calculated manner as a scientist. This is what I'm trying to do. Okay. But, of course, the question is, if there are so many planets that are potentially habitable, and life as it appears is something which develops from the chemistry that is out there and is part of the world we live in, then there should be this kind of microbial biospheres all over the place in our galaxy. And immediately you have to ask yourself the question, well, if that's the case, then some of them should be slightly older than us, and then where are the high technology, beings? Those that can really colonize the galaxy, and that's known as the Fermi paradox. Where are they? You know, where are the highly developed civilizations that should be already out there, and we should be noticing their presence, including here in our solar system? And I think the way I think about it is indeed in terms of those generations, that we we happen to be in this young universe, and we are the first generation. And there is a certain beauty in it that, yes, there are not that many of us in the galaxy, and that's why we're not overrun by, you know, technological civilizations in our own solar system.
Maybe one day.
But,
maybe one
you know,
day we'll get
one
to...
day we'll know how to find out. And finding out the microbial biosphere is the first step, you know, finding out how often is life out there. It's just the way Kepler is the mission that is giving us how often do you have planets like the Earth around other stars. That's the first step and the important step in the Drake equation, as we call it, to estimate that. And then the next step is how often would you have a microbial biosphere, life on a planet like that. And that's what I think within my lifetime we'll be able to estimate. I hope so.
No, that would be exciting.
Then you're in front of the gates of what you offered. You know, how often does this develop into a sentient being, into a technological civilization, which actually survives long enough to make a mark in the galaxy, in the world. And hopefully we will make our own mark in this galaxy as well.
All right, let's go back to final calls now. We'll go to Mike in Rancho Cordova, California. Hey, Mike, thanks for holding. Go ahead. First-time caller.
Hi, George. I love your show.
Thank you, Mike.
My questions are regarding the speed of light. What I'm wondering about is, for example, black holes, light can't escape it. Now, what I wanted to go with this is the mega stars that are out there, when the light leaves these huge stars, can it leave at the speed of light, or does the gravity slow it down until it gets away from that star?
Mike, great question. Speed of light is very important to us astronomers and planet hunters like me, because this is how we actually estimate how far away these planetary systems are, and if it comes to communication one day, we have to think of communicating with electromagnetic waves which move at the speed of light. Now, gravity affects light the same as everything else. So the whole concept of a black hole is that it has such a strong gravitational field near its surface, around it, very close to its, itself, that even light is not capable to overtake the strong force of gravity. And when you have a very large star, you would expect that to be the case as well. The point, however, is that when a star is very large, much larger than the sun, it puffs up a lot because it burns up very fast and very with a lot of power. So it produces so much heat and power that essentially it puffs itself up. So the light that we see coming from very large stars comes from their surface. And that surface is so far removed from the center of gravity that the light still streams out in more or less in a normal fashion. It's only when a large star like that explodes, which doesn't take very long because they burn up very fast, their thermonuclear fuel, is that you form a black hole in many of those cases, we believe. And then, of course, all that light and a lot of the matter ends up being locked up and not able to
escape. What happens when light from another star passes by these gigantic stars? Does it speed up as it approaches and passes it and goes beyond the speed of light?
It can't. And actually, again, if it passes too close to the big star, it basically gets absorbed and scattered in the old-fashioned way by interaction with the large number of atoms that surround stars like that. So when we observe light passing by those stars, we see bending, and there is a word for it. We call it microlensing. We see the bending of the light. In fact, people use it to detect planets that way as well. But we don't see it speeding up or slowing down, certainly not in a measurable way. And certainly, when it comes to speeding up light, our current theory of physics is based on the fact that you can't speed it up beyond that limit, which is the speed of light in vacuum.
Next up, let's go to Jack, Hollywood, California. Hi, Jack. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hey, go ahead, Jack.
Yes, I have a two-part question. One first question is, you know, this NASA has sent all these probes, like the Cassini and the Galileo and the, you know, the Nostradamus, whatever, all the way far away from planet Earth. And I've always wondered, I've never seen a picture of the sun taken from one of these gizmos from that distance. I've seen artist renditions, but I have never actually seen a picture. I would love to see a picture of the sun from like Pluto or somewhere where these gizmos, they leave the solar system and just take one last shot before they disappear. That's my first question to you. Second question is, I have a problem with this 14 billion years of the universe, of the age of the universe, because it seems to me that this is by Earth standard, right? 14 billion years, Earth years, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, well, if you're on Jupiter, Jupiter is 1,000 times bigger than the Earth, and it has a much wider orbit around the sun. So wouldn't that time 1,000? So it would be like 14 billion times, you know what I mean? But the equation would be much higher than the age of the universe if you calculated it from Jupiter, which is 1,000 times bigger than the Earth. So those are my questions, and may God bless you.
Okay, well, let's start with, I guess, the second one first, the age of the universe. How do we know it's that old?
Good question, Jack. We only figured out the age of the universe as precisely as we know it today in the last 10, 15 years. And the reason we could do that was because of two spacecraft, two space experiments, which are observing the sky in the microwave region. We see the so-called cosmic microwave background radiation, essentially radio waves coming from all directions of space in a very smooth and particular way, which was possible to measure with our equipment very accurately. And we see that map of the very distant universe with tiny fluctuations, with tiny clumps of that radio brightness temperature changing. And from the size and the distribution of those clumps and how they arrange on the sky, the whole sky, it's possible to estimate the geometry of space between us and that very distant time and very large distance. The distance and time, because of the speed of light, is the same thing in astronomy. Essentially, with a big telescope, you see the path directly. You don't infer it, you see it. And so when you put that together with the expansion of the galaxies, the expansion of the universe that we observe, and particularly the Hubble Space Telescope made a big contribution to measuring it very accurately, you end up with a direct distance, if you will, between that early time when we see this shining gas in the microwave radiation and today. And that gives you literally the age, the time when this occurred, which comes out to about 13.7 billion years ago. And you can measure it in seconds, you can measure it in years, doesn't matter in what units, whether it's measured from Jupiter or it's measured from the Andromeda galaxy, it will always be the same distance and the same age, the same period of time. And that's what we call the age of the observable universe. So what we observe as the universe in which we live today, all the way to back to what we can see and measure, is 13.7 billion years old. Now, some people will say, well, maybe there was something before that. It was a cyclic universe in which we adjust in this cycle. Well, if we find evidence for that, that will be fine, and then the age of that cycle will be multiplied by the previous cycles. But currently, we can say that the observable universe, the universe we live in and we observe and have evidence for, is exactly 13.7 billion years old.
Very good.
So
let's go.
That was your second question, yeah.
In the first one, very quickly, has any probe taken a shot of the sun looking back?
That's a great question. I need to check on my facts here, but as far as I know, the answer is no. And I think I know why the answer is no, because even from the distance of Saturn or Pluto or beyond that, the sun is so bright that if we point those very sensitive cameras towards the sun, it will essentially burn them. And of course, we don't want to break them. So the most beautiful image that I've seen from out there is from Cassini that you mentioned, Jack, when they made sure to turn the camera towards the sun when the sun was precisely behind Saturn. So you could see the glare from the solar light, but not directly the sun itself, which would have damaged the cameras, I'm sure, of the Cassini spacecraft, which is taking beautiful images of Saturn. And in that image, you can actually see the tiny blue dot, which is the Earth. But the sun is, of course, hidden.
All right, we are rapidly running out of time here, The Life of Super Earths. Dimitar, where do you get this book?
Oh, you can get it as an ebook from Amazon. You can buy it in bookstores.
It's all over the place. All right, very good. I want to thank you for being on the program, and good luck with you in case you ever find anything that, could be earth-shattering. Just let us know if you would. Up next, we're going to talk about artificial intelligence here on Coast to Coast AM, so get ready for that. And later on in the program, we will take your phone calls as well. Split show tonight on Coast to Coast AM. And also, don't forget, Linda Moulton Howe joins us on our Thursday program. It's that time of month where she has a series of incredible stories of high strangeness. Up next, artificial intelligence. Will it take us over? Find out next on Coast to Coast AM.